There's a website called Fantasy Football Nerd. It aggregates predictions from roughly 40 NFL pundits to produce what it calls the industry's most accurate consensus rankings. Now, how accurate is the consensus? Let me give you an example. Early in the 2015-16 NFL season, the Carolina Panthers were slated to play the Seattle Seahawks. Only two of the pundits picked Carolina to win. 36 picked Seattle. And you could see why. Seattle has been one of the best teams in the league for the past several seasons. They won the Super Bowl 2 years ago. They'd be playing Carolina in Seattle, where the home crowd is famously, almost punishingly supportive. So even though Seattle had won only two games this season against three losses, and even though Carolina was an undefeated 4-0 at this point, the experts liked Seattle. They liked their pedigree. But Carolina won the game, 27-23.
It's the hook and ladder. Lockett has it. Lockett's being tackled, flips it, ball's loose, recovered by Seattle at the 40. Carolina has won the football game. What an unbelievable, validating, respect-taking road win for the Carolina Panthers.
Soon afterward, Carolina quarterback Cam Newton faced the media.
Cam, before the Seattle game, a lot of the national media was down on this team. After you guys won that game, now a lot of the national media says this is one of the best teams we've seen this year. Do you ever find it comical the way that a lot of these people think, you know, that, hey, this team is all right, this team's not good, this team might win?
But I find all media comical at times. Because I think in you guys' profession, you can easily take back what you say. And you don't get, it's no danger, you know, when somebody says it. You know, if it was a pay cut, if it was an incentive, if picking teams each and every week, you know, you may get a raise. I guarantee if people will be watching what they say then.
So first of all, let's give Cam Newton a medal, because he just articulated in about 10 seconds a big problem that experts in many fields, along with TV producers and opinion page editors and government officials, either fail to understand or acknowledge, which is this. When you don't have skin in the game and you aren't held accountable for your predictions, you can say pretty much whatever you want.
I completely agree with Cam on that.
That's Jonathan Bales.
A lot of the beat writers in the NFL or cross sports, they just can say whatever they want, and there's no incentive for them to be correct. And I do think that for the most part, they are very bad at making predictions.
Bales can't afford to be bad because he plays fantasy sports for a living.
People who have something to lose from their opinions or the predictions that they make are incentivized to make sure that they're right.
Bales is 30 years old. He lives in Philadelphia. He's written a series of books called Fantasy Football for Smart People. He takes a fairly analytical approach. He says many of the best fantasy sports players do the same.
We question things and we want to improve and we ask why a lot. Like, why am I making lineups this way? Is this truly the best way? Just always questioning everything that we do, taking a very, very data-driven approach to fantasy and adapting and evolving.
Adapting and evolving, using data to make better decisions, challenging the conventional wisdom, that all doesn't sound so hard, does it? When you think that all experts everywhere would do the same, or at the very least, when you think that we would pay better attention to all the bad predictions out there, the political and economic and even sports predictions, and then do something about it, why isn't that happening?
That is indeed the $64,000 question. Why very smart people have been content to have so little accountability for accuracy and forecasting.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, let's fix that. And while we're at it, why don't we all learn to become not just good forecasters, but super forecasters?
Am I a super forecaster? The short answer is not really.
Okay, we won't learn it from him, but maybe from him.
I didn't have any background and had to learn it all from the start.
Or from her.
I had totally missed the 2007-2008 financial crash. I really had very little expertise in terms of international events. On the other hand, I'm fairly skeptical of forecasting.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If you're a longtime listener of this program, you've met Philip Tetlock before.
I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, cross-appointed in Wharton in the School of Arts and Sciences.
We spoke with Tetlock years ago for an episode called The Folly of Prediction.
I think the most important takeaway would be that the experts think they know more than they do. They were systematically overconfident.
Back then, I asked Tetlock to name the distinguishing characteristic of a bad and overconfident forecaster.
Dogmatism.
It can be summed up that easily.
I think so. I think an unwillingness to change one's mind in a reasonably timely way in response to new evidence. A tendency when asked to explain one's predictions to generate only reasons that favor your preferred prediction and not to generate reasons opposed to it.
Tetlock knows this because he conducted a remarkable long-term empirical study focused on geopolitical predictions with nearly 300 participants.
They were very sophisticated political observers. Virtually all of them had some postgraduate education. Roughly two-thirds of them had PhDs. They were largely political scientists, but there were some economists and a variety of other professionals as well.
This study became the basis of a book that Tetlock titled Expert Political Judgment. It was a sly title because the experts' predictions often weren't very expert, which, to Philip Tetlock, is a big problem because forecasting is everywhere.
People often don't recognize how pervasive forecasting is in their lives, that they're doing forecasting every time they make a decision about whether to take a job or whom to marry or whether to take a mortgage or move to another city. We'd make those decisions based on implicit or explicit expectations about how the future will unfold. We spend a lot of money on these forecasts. We base important decisions on these forecasts. And we very rarely think about measuring the accuracy of the forecasts.
Some of us may have been satisfied to merely identify and describe this problem, as Tetlock did. Some of us might have gone a bit further and raised our voices against the problem. But Tetlock went even further than that. He put together a team to participate in one of the biggest forecasting tournaments ever conducted. It was run by a government agency called IARPA.
IARPA is the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, and it is modeled somewhat on DARPA. It aspires to fund cutting-edge research that will produce surprising results that have the potential to revolutionize intelligence analysis.
And Tetlock was at the center of this cutting-edge research. He tells the story in a book called Super Forecasting, co-authored with the journalist Dan Gardner. The book is both a how-to, if at a rather high level, and a cautionary tale about all the flaws that lead so many people to make so many bad forecasts. Dogmatism, as we mentioned earlier, a lack of understanding of probability, and a reliance on what Tetlock calls vague verbiage. These flaws have been evident even among the smartest world leaders making the most critical of decisions.
Well, in the context of the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy administration had just come into power, and they were considering whether to support an effort by Cuban exiles and CIA operatives and others to launch an invasion to depose Castro in April 61. And the Kennedy administration asked the Joint Chiefs of Staff to do an independent review of the plan and offer an assessment of how likely this plan was to succeed. And I believe the vague verbiage phrase that the Joint Chiefs analysts used was they thought there was a fair chance of success. And it was later discovered that by fair chance of success, they meant about 1 in 3. But the Kennedy administration did not interpret fair chance as being 1 in 3. They thought it was considerably higher. So it's an interesting question of whether they would have been willing to support that invasion if they thought the probability were as low as 1 in 3.
As a psychologist, though, you know a lot about how we are predisposed toward interpreting data in a way that confirms our bias or our priors or the decision we want to make, right? So if I am inclined toward action and I see the words fair chance of success, even if attached to that is the probability of 33%, I might still interpret it as a move to go forward, yes?
Absolutely. That's one of the ways in which vague verbiage forecasts can be so mischievous. It's very easy to hear in them what we want to hear. Whereas I think there's less room for distortion if you say 1 in 3 or 2 in 3 chance. There's a big difference between a 1 in 3 chance of success and a 2 in 3 chance of success.
A difference of 1, if I'm doing my math properly.
Right.
Now, the Bay of Pigs didn't really change much in the intelligence community, right? Surprisingly, perhaps. But the WMD issue with Saddam Hussein in Iraq was an embarrassment to the point that the government wanted to do something about it. Is that about right, that IARPA was founded in part out of a response to that?
I'm not sure I understand all of the internal decisions inside the intelligence community, but I think that the false positive judgment on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq did cause a lot of soul-searching inside the U.S. intelligence community and made people more receptive to the creation of something like IARPA, yes.
IARPA was formed in 2006. One of its major goals is, and I quote, anticipating surprise.
I think that's why they decided to fund these forecasting tournaments.
These forecasting tournaments would deal with real issues.
So whether Greece would leave the Eurozone was considered to be an event of national security relevance.
Some other questions.
Whether the Muslim Brotherhood was going to win the elections in Egypt.
Would the president of Austria remain in office?
These are a couple of the forecasters on Tetlock's team.
We were one of 5 university-based research programs that were competing, and the goal was to generate the most accurate possible probability estimates. They set up the performance objectives in 2011, very much based in the wisdom of the crowd tradition. The idea being that the average forecast derived from a group of forecasters is typically more accurate than the majority, often the vast majority, of forecasters from whom the average was derived. So they wanted to see whether or not we could do 20% better than the average, 30%, 40%, 50% as the tournament went on.
Okay, so what did you name your team?
The Good Judgment Project.
It was an optimistic name, if nothing else. The team was put together by Tetlock, his research and life partner Barbara Mellers, who also teaches at Wharton, and Don Moore from the Haas Business School at Berkeley. But here's the thing. You didn't have to be an academic or an expert of any kind to join the Good Judgment Project or any of the other teams in the IARPA tournament. Anyone could sign up online, and tens of thousands of people did, eager to make forecasts about global events.
Each of the research programs had its own distinctive philosophy and approach to generating accurate probability judgments. I think we were probably the most eclectic and opportunistic of the research programs, and I think that helped. And
eclectic and opportunistic, how? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we were ready to roam across disciplines fairly freely. We just didn't care that much about whether we offended particular academic constituencies by exploring particular hypotheses. So we got a lot of pushback on a lot of the things we considered. There was a big debate, for example, about whether it'd be a good idea to have forecasters work in teams. And we didn't really know what the right answer was. There were some good arguments for using teams. There were some good arguments against using teams. But what we did is we ran an experiment. And it turned out that using teams in this sort of context helped quite a bit. There was also a debate about whether it would be feasible to give people training to help reduce some common psychological biases in human cognition. And again, we didn't know for sure what the answer would be, but we ran experiments, and we found out that it was possible to get a surprising degree of improvement by training people, giving people tutorials that warned them against particular biases and offered them some reasoning strategies for improving their accuracy. So we did a lot of things that some psychologists or other people in the social sciences might have disagreed with, and we went with the experimental results.
Give me now some summary stats on the Good Judgment Project's performance overall. First of all, how long did the tournament end up lasting, Phil?
The tournament lasted for 4 years.
Okay. How many questions did IARPA pose?
Roughly 500 questions were posed between 2011 and 2015 inclusive.
And your team, the Good Judgment Project, gathered approximately how many individual judgments about the future?
Let's see, thousands of forecasters, hundreds of questions, forecasters often making more than one judgment per question because the opportunities to update their beliefs. I believe it was in excess of 1 million.
Okay. And how'd you do?
Well, we managed to beat IARPA's performance objectives in the first year. IARPA's fourth year objective was doing 50% better than the unweighted average of the crowd, and our best forecasters and best algorithms are outperforming that even after year one, and they continue to outperform in years two, three, and four. And the Good Judgment Project was the only project that consistently outperformed IARPA's year one and two objectives. So IARPA decided to merge teams, essentially. So the Good Judgment Project was able to absorb some really great talent from the other forecasting teams. And each year, at the end of the year, we creamed off the top 2% of forecasters, and we called them super forecasters. So the top 2% of roughly 3,000 forecasters would be about 60 people or so. And then next year, and the next year, and on it would go.
So the way you're describing the success of the Good Judgment Project now, in your kind of measured academic tone of voice, sounds pretty measured and academic. But let's be real, you kicked butt, yes?
Yep. That's fair enough.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, why the people you think might be super forecasters often are not.
There are plenty of reasons why very smart people don't ever become super forecasters, and plenty of reasons why people who know a ton about politics never become super forecasters.
And Tetlock's super forecasters share their secrets.
I often don't read the newspaper at all, and when I do, it's generally the Omaha World Herald, which isn't remarkable for its foreign policy coverage.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Philip Tetlock is a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania with a longtime interest in forecasting. He has come to two main conclusions. The first one, foresight is real. That's how he puts it in his book, Super Forecasting. The other conclusion has to do with what sets any one forecaster above the crowd. It's not really who they are, he writes. It is what they do. Foresight isn't a mysterious gift bestowed at birth. It is the product of particular ways of thinking, of gathering information, of updating beliefs. These habits of thought can be learned and cultivated by any intelligent, thoughtful, determined person. According to Tetlock, super forecasters are...
They're less likely than ordinary people, regular mortals, to believe in fate or destiny. And they're more likely to believe in chance. You roll enough dice enough times, and improbable coincidences will occur. Our lives are nothing but, you know, quite improbable series of coincidences. Many people find that a somewhat demoralizing philosophy of life. They prefer to think that their lives have deeper meaning. They don't like to think that the person to whom they're married, they could just as easily have wound up happy with 237,000 other people.
What about their level of, let's say, confidence or even arrogance? Is a super forecaster arrogant?
I think they're often proud of what they've accomplished, but I think they're really very humble about their judgments. They know that they're just often very close to forecasting disaster. They need to be very careful. I think it's very difficult to remain a super forecaster for very long in an arrogant state of mind. But that doesn't mean super forecasters are chickens who hang around the maybe zone and never say anything more than minor shades of maybe. You don't win a forecasting tournament by saying maybe all the time. You win a forecasting tournament by taking well-considered bets.
And what about the method of forecasting? Can you talk a little bit about methods that seem to contribute to super forecasters' success?
Well, one of the more distinctive differences between how super forecasters approach a problem and how regular forecasters approach it is that super forecasters are much more likely to use what Danny Kahneman calls the outside view rather than the inside view. So if I asked you a question about whether a particular sub-Saharan dictator is likely to survive in power for another year, a regular forecaster might get to the job by looking up facts about that particular dictator in that particular country, whereas a super forecaster might be more likely to sit back and say, well, how likely are sub-Saharan dictators who have been in power X years likely to survive another year? And the answer for that particular question tends to be very high. It's in the area of 85-95%, depending on the exact numbers at stake. And that means their initial hunch, their initial judgment will be based on the base rate of similar occurrences in the world. They'll start off with that, and then they will gradually adjust in response to idiosyncratic inside view circumstances. So knowing nothing about the African dictator or the country even, let's say I've never heard of this dictator, I've never heard of this country, and I just look at the base rate and I say, oh, it looks like about 87%. That would be my initial hunch estimate. Then the question is, what do I do? Well, then I start to learn something about the country and the dictator. And if I learn that the dictator in question is 91 years old and has advanced prostate cancer, I should adjust my probability. And if I learn that there are riots in the capital city and there's hints of military coups in the offing, I should again adjust my probability. But starting with the base rate probability is a good way to at least ensure that you're going to be in the plausibility ballpark initially.
And what about IQ?
I think it's fair to say that it helps a lot to be a somewhat above average intelligence if you want to become a super forecaster. It also helps a lot to know more about politics than most people do. I would say they're almost necessary conditions for doing well, but they're not sufficient because there are plenty of people who are very smart and close-minded. There are plenty of people who are very smart and think that it's impossible to attach probabilities to unique events.
It is very hard to become a super forecaster, Tetlock makes clear, unless you have a very good grip on probability.
We talk in the book with a great poker player, Aaron Brown, who's the chief risk officer of AQR.
AQR is an investment and asset management firm in Greenwich, Connecticut.
He defined the difference between a great poker player, a world-class poker player, and a talented amateur as the world-class player knows the difference between a 60-40 proposition or a 40-60 proposition. And then he paused and said, no, more like 55-45, 45-55. Now, when you make that claim in the context of poker, most people nod and say, sure, that sounds right, because poker, you're sampling from a well-defined universe, you have repeated play, you have clear feedback. But if you ask people, well, what's the likelihood of a violent Sino-Japanese clash in the East China Sea in the next 12 months or another outbreak of bird flu somewhere, most people say, how could you possibly assign probabilities to what seem to be unique historical events? The best we can really do is make vague verbiage forecasts. We can say things like, well, this might happen, this could happen, this may happen, and it's impossible to learn to make better probability judgments if you conceal those probability judgments under the cloak of vague verbiage.
Thank you all. It is time to start the debate. Are you all ready?
It is 9 p.m. on the East Coast, and the moment of truth has arrived.
Live from St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire, the Democratic Debate.
Let me ask you this. If you were asked to introduce one question into an upcoming presidential debate, let's say, that you feel would give some insight via the candidate's answers, the insight into their views overall on forecasting, our limits and the need for it. What kind of question would you try to ask?
What a wonderful question that is. You've taken me aback. It's such a good question. I'm going to have to think hard about that. I don't have an answer right off the top of my head, but I would love to have the opportunity to draft such a question. It would be something along the lines of, would it be a good thing for the advisors to the president to make an effort to express uncertainty in numerical terms and to keep record of how accurate or inaccurate they are over time? Would you like to have presidential daily briefings in which, instead of the document saying this could or might or may happen, it says our best analysts, when we crowdsource our best analysts, the probability seems to range somewhere between 0.35 and 0.6. You know, that still sounds, it's still a pretty big zone of uncertainty, but it sure is a lot better than could, which could mean anything from 0.01 to 0.99.
Now, can you imagine anyone saying they wouldn't want that, though? Do you think there are those who'd want to show that they're so, macho that no, we don't want to traffic in that?
I think there's vast variation among politicians in how numerate they are and in how open they are to thinking of their beliefs as gradations along an uncertainty continuum rather than expressions of tribal loyalties. We have the story in the book about President Obama making the decision about going after Osama bin Laden and the probability estimates he got about Osama's location and how he dealt with those probabilities. The probabilities range from about, I don't know, from around, maybe from 0.4 to about 0.95 with a center of gravity around 0.75. And the president's reaction was to shrug and say, well, I don't know what to do with this. It feels like a 50-50 thing, a coin toss. Now, that's an understandable reaction from a president who is about to make an important decision and feels he's getting somewhat conflicting advice and feels like he doesn't have closure on a problem. It's a common way to use the language. But it's not how the president would have used the language if he'd been sitting in the TV room in the White House with buddies watching March Madness and Duke University is playing and someone says, you know, what's the likelihood of Duke winning this game? And his friends offer probabilities ranging from 0.5 to about 0.95 with a center of gravity of 0.75, once again. He wouldn't say sounds like 50-50. He'd say sounds like 3-1. Now, how much better decisions would politicians make if they achieved that improvement in granularity, accuracy, calibration? We don't know. I think that if the intelligence community had been more diffident about its ability to assign probability estimates, the term slam dunk probably wouldn't have materialized in the discourse about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I think the actual documents themselves would have been written in a more circumspect fashion. I think there were good reasons for thinking Saddam Hussein was doing something suspicious. I'm not saying that the probability would have been less than 50%. The probability might have been as high as 85% or 80%, but it wouldn't have been 100%.
But I wonder how much of this is our fault, our meaning the public, because, you know, when someone makes a decision that turns out poorly, not wrong necessarily, but poorly, even if the odds were very much in his or her favor, we punish them for the way that turned out. I mean, forget about politics. Go to something as silly as football. If a head football coach goes for it on fourth down when all the probability is encouraging him to do so and his team doesn't make it, we know what happens. All the sports fans come out and say, this guy was an idiot. What the hell was he doing? He didn't properly calculate the risk. Whereas, in fact, he calculated the risk exactly right. And maybe there was an 80% probability of success and he happened to hit the 20%. So we don't respond well to probabilistic choices. And maybe that's why our leaders don't abide by them.
That's right. I mean, part of the obstacle is in us. We've met the enemy and the enemy is us. We don't understand how probability works very well. We have a very hard time taking the outside view toward the forecast we make, the forecast other people make. And if we did get in the habit of keeping score more, we might gradually become a little more literate.
So who are these people, these probability understanding, humble, open-minded, inside view people that have the power of super forecasting?
Until I got into grad school, I was used to being the smartest person in the room. And grad school very quickly disabused me of that notion.
That's one of them. His name is Bill Flack. He's a 56-year-old retiree in rural Nebraska. And he is a super forecaster with the Good Judgment Project, one of the top 2%. Flack studied physics in college, got a master's in math, and even though he wanted to get his PhD,
I just came to realize that I didn't have either the mental power or the commitment to the subject to pursue a PhD.
As smart as he is, Flack admits he is not very worldly.
I often don't read the newspaper at all, and when I do, it's generally the Omaha World Herald, which isn't remarkable for its foreign policy coverage.
Flack wound up working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He was semi-retired when he first read about the Good Judgment Project.
Basically, I thought it sounded kind of interesting and like might be fun to try.
It's an area that's always been interesting to me, how people make decisions.
And that is Mary Simpson, another of Tetlock's super forecasters.
I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and spent my first 18 years there. Had a typical suburban family, older brother, younger sister, stay-at-home mom. Dad was an engineer, you know, the typical breadwinner. And I went to college in Dallas at Southern Methodist University. And that was the time when a lot of women were discovering that they could do things besides get married and have children. So I sort of broadened my horizons, found economics, and was really interested in it and decided I wanted to do something besides get married and have kids. I finished a PhD from Claremont Graduate School and went to work for the big local public utility, Southern California Edison, as an assistant economist.
That's where Simpson was still working when she got involved with the Good Judgment Project. It was just a few years after the financial crash, which Simpson had failed to foresee.
I had totally missed the 2007-2008 financial crash. I had seen bits and pieces. I knew that there was certainly a housing bubble, but I did not connect any of the dots to the underlying financing issues that had really created the major disruption in the financial industry and, the subsequent Great Recession.
Simpson didn't think her forecasts for the Good Judgment Project would be much better.
You know, it's one of those things where I'm a very analytical person, always decent in math, and learned over the years how to kind of assess situations and make predictions. On the other hand, I'm fairly skeptical of forecasting. My company spent thousands of dollars every year for the best in the class of economic forecasts. That's what they were. We had to forecast. We had to understand where sales would go and be able to make predictions in order to be sure that there was enough power and to assess revenue levels and costs of electricity and so forth. So we relied on forecasts, but they were often wrong. So again, I was hopeful to do a decent job, but also very skeptical of the ability of anyone to forecast in certain arenas especially.
Simpson, like Bill Flack, got involved in the forecasting tournament mostly for fun.
I was only working part-time and felt like I needed to keep my brain engaged.
It was a volunteer position. They weren't being paid by the Good Judgment Project, though they did get
an Amazon gift certificate.
What was it worth?
Oh, a couple of $100. It was not a lot.
If you took the value of the Amazon gift certificate and divided by the hours we put into it, we were getting something like 20 cents an hour.
So here were a couple of non-experts in the realm of geopolitics being asked to make a series of geopolitical predictions.
They didn't have any background and had to learn it all from the start.
I really had very little expertise in terms of international events.
Pretty much every single question I had to dig for background information.
You need to understand the facts on the ground. You need to understand the players, what their motives are.
Spend a lot of time with Google News. Sometime with Wikipedia, which I mostly used as a source of sources, basically.
You know, I have an analytical bent. I'm interested in doing the research.
And, you know, pretty much had to educate myself up on the subject.
A lot of it is the work. You know, you have to do the work, you have to update, you have to really stay engaged. And if you simply answer the questions once and let them go and don't look at them again, you're not going to be a very good forecaster.
One of the unusual things about how questions are asked in forecasting tournaments is that they're asked extremely explicitly.
That's Tetlock again.
It's not just, will Greece leave the Eurozone? But there are very specific meanings to what leaving the Eurozone means, and there's a very specific time frame within which this would need to happen.
It's not simply answering yes or no on a question. The answer had to be, what is your expectation of this event happening? In other words, is it 50% or is it 90%? So, you know, there was a certain amount of effort to figure out, well, what's a good probability?
Each of us learned from previous questions how, whether they were being overconfident and underconfident on specific types of questions. We were getting pretty much constant feedback. Every time a question resolved, we knew whether we were right or wrong, whether we'd been overconfident and underconfident. And we tried to look back and see what we had on questions where we'd gone wrong, how we'd gone wrong, on questions where we'd done well, what we had done right, were we lucky, had we followed a very good approach that we should apply to other questions.
And so these typical Americans with no foreign policy experience whatsoever wound up making remarkably accurate forecasts about things like the Grexit or whether there would be conflict in the South China Sea.
One of the things I liked about Good Judgment was it gave me a pretext to learn about these various foreign policy issues.
I think there's certain satisfaction in knowing that you're actually helping research that will hopefully lead to better assessments and better forecasts on the part of government.
Certainly, I've got a good deal less patient with pundits who issue forecasts where, this could happen, but don't attempt to assign a probability to it. Don't suggest how it could go the other way. You probably won't like this answer, but I've grown much less fond of radio news because in trying to make forecasts, I've been really looking for details, and it annoys me greatly when the radio starts a story about something that could be interesting, and then they go into anecdotes instead. Public radio is as bad as the rest, I'm afraid.
I'm going to take the high road, let that public radio comment slide right by. The important thing is this. As Philip Tetlock makes clear, becoming a super forecaster is a tremendous amount of work, but that's what it is. Hard work, not magic or a talent people are born with.
I think that's a deep truth, a deep lesson of the research that we conducted. Sometimes I'm asked, how is it that a group of people, regular citizens who didn't have access to classified information working part-time, were able to generate probability estimates that were more accurate than those generated by intelligence analysts working full-time jobs and with access to classified information? How is that possible? And I don't think it's because the people we recruited are more intelligent than intelligence analysts. I'm pretty sure that's not true. I don't think it's even because they're more open-minded, and it's certainly not because they know more about politics. It's because our forecasters, unlike many people in Washington, D.C., believe that probability estimation of messy real-world events is a skill that can be cultivated and is worth cultivating, and hence they dedicate real effort to it. But if you shrug your shoulders and say, look, there's no way we can make predictions about unique historical events, you're never going to try.
Philip Tetlock has been running forecasting tournaments for roughly 30 years now, and the success of the Good Judgment Project has dictated his next move.
It's led me to decide that the last part of my career, I want to dedicate the last part of my career to improving the quality of public debate, and that I see forecasting tournaments as a tool that can be used for that purpose. I believe that if partisans in debates felt that they were participating in forecasting tournaments in which their accuracy could be compared against that of their competitors, we would quite quickly observe the depolarization of many polarized political debates. People would become more circumspect, more thoughtful, and I think that would, on balance, be a better thing for our society and for the world. So I think there are some tangible ways in which the forecasting tournament technology can be used to improve the quality of public debate if only we were open to the possibility.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, Americans are better at gambling their money away than saving it.
So why don't we take that appetite for gambling and attach it to a savings vehicle that offers some positive return. It's a win-win situation.
And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at freakonomics.com, where you can also find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
There's something Peter Tufano wants to know about you. If you had to, could you come up with $2,000 in 30 days? That's the question he asked a whole bunch of people in 13 countries, including the U.S.
Why $2,000? Because an auto transmission is about $1,500. Most estimates of what everyday emergencies are about are in that order of magnitude. If you were to have a sick or ailing relative on the other side of the country and you had to buy full-price plane tickets, it could easily be that amount. And then why this language come up with as opposed to save? Because what we wanted to see if people had access to resources between savings and credit and friends and family. And about half of Americans are not able to come up with $2,000 in 30 days, which means that they stand only one emergency or crisis away from really quite dire circumstances.
Tufano has spent more than three decades in academia, first at Harvard and now at Oxford Said Business School, trying to figure out why consumers do what they do. He wants to know how many checks you write and for what, how much you borrow and why, and especially this, why Americans are so bad at saving money. Our personal savings rate has been plunging for more than 20 years, actually went negative in 2006. The Great Recession shocked it back into the positive. It's been at about 5% since 2008, but now it started to fall again. Think about what Tufano just said. Half of us don't have access to enough money to survive one breakdown. And it's not just people who don't earn a lot of money. Tufano found that more than 20% of the households earning more than $150,000 a year couldn't come up with that $2,000 in 30 days. Americans are, however, pretty good at spending money. For example, last year we spent over $73 billion, that's nearly $600 per household, on something that isn't very practical.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to number 999,999,999th draw of our national lottery!
That's right, lottery tickets. Melissa Carney is an economist at the University of Maryland. When she was in grad school, she used to stop at a little store in the evening to get milk and orange juice, and she noticed lots and lots of people buying lottery tickets.
And so I just sort of started chatting with the vendor, and he said, oh, I have people coming in spending hundreds, thousands of dollars on lottery tickets a month, a year. And so being a graduate student, I just downloaded some data and started playing around and was struck in particular people do spend a lot of money buying lottery tickets.
So let's walk through some of the numbers on lottery gambling. In the U.S., how many people play the lottery?
Half of U.S. adults surveyed say they play the lottery at some point in the past year.
And would that make it the most popular form of gambling in the U.S.?
Yeah, so by far. So 2 out of 3 American adults report gambling, and it's 50% say they play lottery. The next closest is casino, which is, about 1 in 5 adults.
And why do so many people play the lottery? Because it's fun. For a dollar or two, you buy the chance to dream big. Now, this remarkable bargain illustrates a phenomenon, a probabilistic oddity that economists call skewness.
That's the idea that there's some big prize way out there that corresponds to a very small odd, but there's some potential of capturing that. And that's what your typical, money market account can't give you, right? So you can have $1,500 in your money market account, and every month you might earn, a dollar on it. But there's no chance in every month will you earn, $100,000 or even $10,000.
Now, I know as an economist, you're not trained to answer this question, but as a human being, tell me, why is skewness so important to us?
That's the chance of changing your life, right? That's the return, that's the big win outcome that might allow you to buy a beach house or, to send your kids to college, or if it's less far out in the distribution, that might be what you need to make a down payment on a house or buy a car or throw your daughter the wedding you want to throw her.
For a lot of people, skewness has an irresistible appeal. And so a handful of researchers like Melissa Carney are trying to harness its power, the unlikely chance of changing your life with a big prize, in order to solve America's low savings rate. The idea is a new financial product that combines the thrill of the lottery with the goal of maybe accumulating more than $2,000 in a savings account so that a broken transmission doesn't become a full-blown crisis. Here's Carney's pitch.
So we know Americans like gambling. They always have. The majority of them do it, and they're going to keep doing it. And so what we do is take seriously the idea that people want some small chance of winning a large sum of money. That market, that asset is missing from the American landscape. Okay, low-wealth individuals, the only asset available to them that gives them some chance of accumulating a large amount of money is the state lottery. And in fact, a recent national survey of 1,000 adults, 1 in 5 American adults said their greatest chance of accumulating, hundreds of thousands of dollars was through the lottery. That number jumps to 40% for folks making less than $25,000 a year. So, a lot of Americans think the lottery is their only chance at winning big sums of money. Why don't we take that appetite for gambling, for a product like this, and attach it to a savings vehicle that offers some positive return. It's a win-win situation.
This win-win situation has already worked in many other countries. It's called a prize-linked savings plan, or PLS. Here's how it works. People deposit money in a bank, or maybe they buy a government bond, and instead of receiving the going rate of interest, they'll get a smidge less, maybe a quarter of a percentage point less. And all those smidges are then gathered up into a prize pool. And cash prizes are distributed from that pool, just like lottery winnings, maybe once a month, to a few lucky winners. And the losers, well, there are no losers, really. Everyone keeps his original savings. So you could call a PLS plan a no-lose lottery. It's the kind of idea that can really catch fire.
My name is Robert Cape. I worked at First National Bank for 11 years, where I headed up the investment product house. And our focus was trying to look at ways of growing the funding base of the bank.
First National Bank is in South Africa. In 2005, it started what would turn out to be a phenomenally successful PLS program. Millions of black South Africans did not use banks for anything. Robert Cape wanted to find a way to get some of them in the door.
Now, in South Africa, because so much of the population is unbanked, so much of the savings are literally sitting under mattresses. Now, this has got a double effect. The one that it does really do badly at is it removes that funding from the mainstream banking environment. So it can't be harnessed to lend out and fund economic growth because retail funding tends to come in from consumers and then get lent out to businesses who can then create jobs. So that was the one problem. And the second problem was really that these people with the money under mattresses were excluded from the banking system. And by being excluded from the banking system, you miss out on so many benefits which really help with people's individual development. For example, developing credit records, being less exposed to having your money stolen or lost on the way home.
But Cape's bank had a problem. Interest rates at the time weren't keeping up with inflation, so putting your money in a plain old savings account might actually erode its value. Cape's job was to make it worthwhile for customers to deposit new money. So instead of simply offering an account with a scrawny interest rate, he would offer an account with practically no interest at all, but it came with the chance for a really big payday.
So what we did, we literally pooled all of these little 0.25% of interest. And then what we did, we paid out that interest in lump sums to a few people. So we paid out 150 people a month in lump sum prizes. So the first prize would be R1 million, which is an enormous amount of money in South Africa. And then there were three prizes of R100,000. And then we went down to R20,000 and a few prizes of R1,000. We called it the million a month account.
Mama.
And Mama became the trivial name for it.
And you're the man who gave birth to Mama?
Yes.
How successful was Mama?
Hugely. Probably too successful for its own good.
Mama attracted more than 1 million new customers to Cape's bank. Other banks in South Africa took note and complained to regulators. And then Cape's bank heard from someone else, the South African National Lottery.
We first engaged with them and tried to discuss it, but it was very clear that they were in no position or not wanting to even try to discuss what the issues were. And so they took us to court to have us closed down.
In court, the South African National Lottery argued that First National Bank's PLS program infringed upon the lottery's domain. And it noted that PLS customers were surrendering their rightful interest payment on their savings. As opposed, that is, to surrendering the entire price of a lottery ticket. Anyway, the court sided with the lottery, and the PLS program was shut down. Robert Cape stands by the program's success. He says that 20% of the PLS accounts were opened by people who were previously unbanked. In 2009, after First National Bank's PLS program was shut down, Cape was invited to Washington to talk to federal banking officials about its success. Now, at the time, a bank in the United States couldn't set up a no-lose lottery either. Why not? Because the only legal lotteries here are those that are run by the states themselves. Nice monopoly if you can get it, right? State lotteries generate billions in revenues, and so while most state houses might like to help their citizens save more money, they may not be willing to pit their own lotteries against a rival lottery run by a bank. But in 2009, the same year that MAMA was shut down in South Africa, Peter Tufano and some colleagues found a legal loophole in Michigan that let them set up a PLS plan there with some credit unions. Here's Dave Adams, CEO of the Michigan Credit Union League.
You know, banking can actually be pretty boring. It's not like we go to social events and talk about how much we're saving and talk about a great new feature on our new checking account. So what people want and need is a fun way to save. And in Michigan, we've come up with what we think will accomplish that. It's a program called Save to Win. And what it is it's using a lottery concept so that for every $25 they put into one of these one-year certificates of deposit, they're going to get a chance at cash prizes. And the cash prizes are given out every month by participating credit unions, ranging from $50 to $500. And then there's a grand prize at the end of the year, an opportunity to win a $100,000 grand prize.
So even with a sputtering economy and unappetizing interest rates, a handful of credit unions in Michigan opened 16,000 new savings accounts. Who were these new customers? More than 60% of them had spent money on the lottery or gambling in the previous 6 months, and 46% of them currently had no savings account. The first grand prize winner was named Billie June Smith. We got to speak to her a few years ago before she died at the age of 91. She says she was never very good at saving money, much preferred to play the lottery. But when she learned about her credit union's Save to Win plan, she started buying $25 certificates of deposit. So you put $75 of your own money into a credit union savings account.
Right.
And as a result, you were entered into a lottery for which you won $100,000.
Right.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal to me. What do you think?
Well, it is. It has helped me a lot.
Now tell me what you've done with the money, Billy.
Well, my place is a double wide, and I had bought that way back when I retired. And we have removed the siding and put new siding on it. We done it ourselves. My daughter and her husband live with me now. And I've had to replace the furnace just a month ago, and I've put in water softener, and I have put my money aside for the taxes, and I do have another savings that I don't touch for just so long, and I can add to it then.
Now, what about all the Save to Win customers in Michigan who didn't win? Well, they are on their way to their own reward, passing Peter Tufano's test. They'll have money in the bank when a transmission conks out or when they need to fly across the country to visit a sick relative. If you like this prize-linked savings idea, you will be pleased to know that in 2014, President Obama signed into law the American Savings Promotion Act. As a result, 16 states have already passed legislation that allows for some kind of a PLS plan. Legislation is pending in 12 more. In a country where it's easy to borrow your way to bankruptcy, where you can buy lottery tickets whenever you buy a loaf of bread, PLS is like a big neon billboard that turns a boring old savings account into an exaggeration of itself. Stick some money in here, it says, and you just might hit a big payday. And even if you don't, well, your money still belongs to you. I'll buy that for a dollar, wouldn't you? I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.